allies are in a very, very difficult position to fight back against Beijing.
We will explore if China is trying to drive a wedge between the United States and its allies. This is Wednesday, the 6th of February, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Join us on VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, human rights organizations are calling on the UN for an international investigation into China's mass incarceration of about a million ethnic Uyghurs and other Muslims. And Australia says it will no longer detain children in its migrant camp on an island. It's all on today's VOA Asia. China is trying to isolate the United States by going after its allies. That is the opinion of at least one analyst. Thomas Wright of the Brookings Institution in Washington told the Guardian newspaper that China is trying to divide and conquer. It wants to put maximum pressure on individual countries and not have them band together. After the arrest of Huawei executive Meng Wanzhou in Canada at the request of the United States, action against three Canadians who were in China was taken by Chinese officials. Two of the Canadians were and still are being detained. The third had a drug sentence changed to death. I spoke about this situation with Asia security expert and consultant Rory Daniels. She said what China is now doing is nothing new.
What China is doing is figuring out how to use its national power to meet its national goals. And it has exercised this power coercively against U.S. allies in Asia before. It did so in 2012 against Japan when it banned rare earth metals after the government in Tokyo purchased a set of islands in the East China Sea that Beijing claims as their own territory. And it did so more recently in 2017 and 2018 against a South Korean department store and conglomerate, the Lotte Group, when the Lotte Group in South Korea gave some real estate to a U.S. radar system, which Beijing claimed could peek into its own territory and believed was targeted against China's security interests. So when it comes to China using national power, what we see is that it prefers bilateral relationships and it prefers to use its economic leverage to coerce or persuade other countries to meet security goals that are beneficial for Beijing.
Is this type of pressure unique to China, or do other countries use it as well?
I would say that probably every country tries to use its leverage to meet its national goals, but what may be different about China is the amount of power it has gained so quickly, and therefore its ability to use that leverage, and also the idea that China may perhaps be pursuing these goals outside of a rules-based framework in which there is an equitable resolution instead of a power-based resolution.
Do you see this being successful on their part, on Beijing's part?
It's successful, but it's not without consequence. So whether or not the short-term successes, for example, coming later to a deal with Japan to shelve the territorial disputes, or creating economic incentives for countries to join the Belt and Road Initiative, are successful in the long term remains to be seen. In the short term, we're seeing some successes, but also a lot of backlash against some of the practices, particularly investment projects that are not sustainable long term because of the debt they create in the target country.
You're basically talking about Belt and Road, right?
Correct.
All right. Now, give me an example as to how that would be incorporated.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could take the example of the Philippines. So the Philippines has territorial disputes with China in the South China Sea. It brought that case to an international arbitration court. The international arbitration court ruled in favor of the Philippines at the same time that the Philippines had elected a new president, Duterte, who wanted to pursue closer relations with Beijing. So Duterte went to Beijing shortly after this ruling was announced and signed an astronomical series of investment deals in Beijing, and at the press conference to announce those deals, made mention that they would not be seeking enforcement for the arbitration ruling.
What are some of these allies doing to fight back against Beijing, if indeed they are doing that?
I think the allies are in a very, very difficult position to fight back against Beijing. On the one hand, you are seeing more scrutiny of Belt and Road investment projects. Even Pakistan, who has traditionally been a stalwart partner of Beijing, is rethinking some of the commitments that it's made to accept Belt and Road financing. But in reality, China is a huge economic power. It has a lot of growth potential still, and most countries want to be involved in China's economic success story. So every country at this point is working very individually to figure out how to balance their need to participate in China's economy with some of these strategies of coercive leverage that come as part of the bargain. What would be an effective strategy would be for all of the allies to band together on this front and really present China with a framework in which funding can be transparent and rules-based. But we're not seeing a great deal of global coordination on those efforts.
Our appreciation to Asia security expert and consultant Rory Daniels for being with us on VOA Asia. These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now on voanews.com. The U.S. State Department says the special U.S. envoy for North Korea will travel to Pyongyang this week to finalize plans for the upcoming second summit between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim. 50,000 pilgrims went missing during a second grand bath at the Kumbh Mela festival in northern India after becoming separated from loved ones. Camps were set up to reunite family and friends. Thousands of Beijing residents and travelers flocked to temples across the city to mark the first day of the Year of the Pig with prayers and festivities. The U.S. Trade Agency sees negotiating new WTO rules to rein in China as being futile. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. 16 leading global human rights organizations are calling for an international investigation into China's mass incarceration of some 1 million ethnic Uyghurs and other Turkic Muslims in Xinjiang province. The groups are urging the United Nations Human Rights Council, which begins its next session later this month, to adopt a resolution establishing an international fact-finding mission to Xinjiang. Lisa Schlein has more for VOA from Geneva.
This issue first came to light in August when the UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination reviewed China's human rights record. One of the committee members unexpectedly confronted the Chinese delegation about reports of 1 million Uyghurs being held in large detention centers in Xinjiang. Sarah Brooks, an Asia advocate for the group International Service for Human Rights, describes the development as a turning point.
It became a moment where, much to its surprise, the Chinese government and the delegation that they sent here to Geneva to stand in front of that committee of experts really were put in the hot seat. They had to answer very difficult questions, and I think they found themselves needing to be able to muster a response which was more than it doesn't exist.
Over time, that response has evolved to try to get ahead of worldwide criticism. China now acknowledges it is holding Uyghurs and other Turkic Muslims in so-called political or vocational education camps. Ken Roth, executive director of Human Rights Watch, says the Chinese government claims it is trying to counter extremism and terrorism, a claim he refutes.
The purpose of this detention is to erase the ethnic and religious identities of Turkic Muslims and ensure their loyalty to only the Chinese government, the Communist Party, and the would-be leader for life, Xi Jinping.
Human rights groups report people in the camps are subjected to forced political indoctrination, are pressured to renounce their faith, are frequently mistreated, and in some cases tortured. They say detainees are denied contact with their families, given no access to lawyers, and are being held with no end in sight. Kumi Naidu, the Secretary General of Amnesty International, calls Xinjiang an outdoor prison. He says it is a place of high surveillance, political indoctrination, forced cultural assimilation, arbitrary arrests, and disappearances. He says ethnic minorities have been turned into strangers in their own land.
So large is the number of people detained that the government had to open up orphanages to take in the children of families whose parents were being re-educated. Yet China continues to obfuscate and deny access to the region to independent observers, despite repeated requests by the United Nations and others.
Naidu says China must be held accountable for its repressive actions. He says member states must act by mandating the UN to investigate the situation. Kenneth Roth says he agrees. Given the scale of the atrocities being committed by China, he says the muted global outcry is deeply regrettable.
People worldwide were rightly outraged by Trump's Muslim travel ban. But when China forces 1 million Muslims to renounce Islam on pain of endless detention, the response has largely been ho-hum.
Roth says a UN fact-finding mission to Xinjiang is urgently needed to bring the truth to light, particularly in the face of China's denials and conflicting narratives. He notes the integrity of the UN Human Rights Council is at stake. A principle of defense in human rights, he says, is holding even the most powerful council members to account, especially when the abuses are so severe. He adds the public shaming that comes from a formal investigation and exposure of the mass detentions is the only thing that is likely to change China's treatment of the Uyghurs. The greatest concentration of Muslims in China is in Xinjiang province, where 10 million Uyghurs live. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Happening now in Asia, Facebook is banning four armed insurgent groups in Myanmar from its platform. The U.S.-based social media giant announced Tuesday in a written statement that it has designated the Arakan Army, the Myanmar Democratic Alliance Army, the Kachin Independence Army, and the Ta'ang Liberation as dangerous organizations to justify its decision to ban the groups from the site. This is VOA Asia. Australia says it will no longer detain children in its migrant camp on the Pacific island of Nauru. The last remaining group of four children is preparing to fly to the United States with their families, all part of a 2016 resettlement deal with Washington. From Sydney, Phil Mercer has more.
In August, there were more than 100 children held on Nauru. Australia refused to resettle them under tough immigration policies meant to deter asylum seekers arriving by sea. Critics said the young detainees were being damaged for life, and there was intense pressure on the minority government in Parliament. Prime Minister Scott Morrison has confirmed that children will no longer be detained on Nauru, although several hundred adult detainees remain on the island. Morrison said his administration had stopped asylum boats and had prevented tragic drownings at sea. He's also conceding ground on the controversial issue of transferring refugees to Australia for medical treatment. A new independent panel of medical experts will review any decision by immigration authorities to refuse to allow sick and injured detainees from offshore camps in the South Pacific to Australia for treatment. The concession is a bid by the Prime Minister to prevent a humiliating defeat on the issue in Parliament next week. Independent Federal MP Karen Phelps says the government has been slow to act.
The only reason that children have been removed from detention is because of community pressure. The government was keeping children there for 5 years or more without any hope of a future of freedom or safety until the community put pressure on them. And now we're seeing that the medical profession is needing to step up along with refugee advocates to say the medical situation on Manus Island, Nauru, is unacceptable and needs to change.
Australia has detained asylum seekers arriving by sea on the tiny Republic of Nauru since the facility was reopened in 2012. Another Australian-run facility at Manus Island in Papua New Guinea closed in October 2017. Although several hundred refugees and asylum seekers remain on the island in community accommodation, their futures are uncertain. Since 2013, the Australian Navy has been ordered to tow or turn back migrant boats. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming up, can robots save the Great Barrier Reef? You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This news alert from VOA Asia, the United States and South Korea have reached agreement in principle on sharing the cost of stationing U.S. troops in the Asian country. That announcement from the U.S. State Department, CNN quoted the department as saying that under the revised agreement, South Korea would boost its financial contribution to nearly U.S. $1 billion. This is VOA Asia. We continue now. A major reversal by an Asia-based company most likely brings a smile to the President of the United States. VOA Asia's Skylar Ogden is here with this week's business scene.
Taiwanese electronics giant Foxconn is moving forward with plans to build a factory in Wisconsin. The company is a major supplier for various tech companies, including Apple. Terry Guo is Foxconn's chairman.
The U.S. is the largest market in the world. It has the best talent and the most advanced technology. It also has the best economic environment. From the standpoint of our company, investing in the U.S. is undoubtedly a right decision and fits with the future economic trends.
The announcement is an about-face for the technology company, which had previously said it would not build in Wisconsin because of the changing global climate and Trump's trade war with China. Foxconn assembles most of its products in China, leaving it acutely vulnerable to Trump's tariffs. The backlash in Wisconsin to that decision was strong. The state had promised Foxconn big state tax breaks, and Trump had been touting the number of blue-collar jobs it would bring to the state. Chairman Terry Guo left out the details, but credited a personal conversation with Trump as the reason for the decision's reversal.
President Trump yesterday shared with me the progress on the U.S.-China trade negotiation and said it is going smoothly and there will be a deal soon.
Foxconn originally planned to build a factory that would produce LCD flat-screen televisions, promising around 13,000 new manufacturing jobs. But it's unclear if the Wisconsin-based facility will be a manufacturing hub or more of a research and engineering center. The company did not provide details on its new commitment. Airports in China are seeing record passenger flows as the Spring Festival kicks off. Also known as the Chinese New Year, the Spring Festival marks the beginning of the lunar calendar and runs from February 4th to approximately February 18th. 10 large airports are operating around the clock during the Spring Festival travel rush. In the city of Zhengzhou, passenger trips have exceeded 90,000 daily on average, setting a record for the last 22 years. Despite the slowing economy, the number of passengers who will take flights is up by 12% compared with last year. The Spring Festival is the country's largest seasonal migration of people as families reunite for the year's most important traditional holiday. For VOA's business scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
Now this news alert from VOA Asia. Japan's Deputy Prime Minister Taro Aso has been forced to retract remarks that appeared to blame women who don't have children for problems associated with that country's low birth rate and aging population. Media quoted him as saying there are lots of weird people who say the elderly are at fault, but that's incorrect. Rather, those who aren't giving birth to children are the problem. This is VOA Asia. As the year began, splinter rebel groups in Myanmar's Karen State came together for the Karen Revolution Day, marking 70 years since fighting broke out at the start of 1949 between the once-united Karen National Union and Burmese forces. Despite a tenuous national ceasefire agreement, the Karen National Union signed in 2015, territorial disputes continue, stalling the peace process and leading the Karen group to suspend talks last October. Steve Sanford speaks to key players in the struggle to find a sustainable solution for the Karen people.
Here on the Thai border, it wasn't unusual in the past to see ethnic Karen fleeing from army attacks in Myanmar. But times and technology have changed dramatically, including ways to get the word out about the 70th anniversary of Karen Revolution Day.
At the moment, we communicate with each other through social media like Facebook. We created a Facebook page for communication to contact other youth groups, and sometimes we help contact Karen groups at the office.
Despite modernization, traditional goals remain as the Karen people continue to seek autonomy and control over their territory. For experienced veterans, army tactics like reinforcing military posts during ceasefire agreements is nothing new.
The ceasefire is part of a good thing, but in Brigade 5, the Burmese army are restricted from entering the area, so they try to instigate a conflict. They try to find a way to start a conflict in many different ways and blame the KNU side for breaking the ceasefire when actually they are the guilty party.
Despite government denials of the violations, the Karen splinter groups have called for reunification in defense against Myanmar troops. Sideline meetings at the anniversary event also attracted peace delegates and politicians, including former political prisoner Koko G.
Federalism, the federal union, is the political objective. For that reason, we're trying to solve the problems politically. So by doing so, we can reduce the arms conflict in our country and to get the political aim for the ethnic people.
As the Karen people wrap up another year of unrest and indecision, most are just waiting for the fighting to end and the permanent rebuilding to begin. Steve Sanford for VOA News in Karen State, Myanmar.
Climate change is heating up the oceans, killing coral reefs worldwide. Scientists in Australia are hoping robots can help bring them back. VOA's Steve Barragona has the story.
It's like a delivery drone for baby coral. Queensland University technology professor Matthew Dunbabin developed the robot. It's called Larvalbot. It transports coral embryos to damaged reefs.
As it swims along, we can target where we want to distribute that to the areas that are needed. And the idea being that we'll create new coral reefs that have been previously damaged by bleaching and other events.
Australia's Great Barrier Reef suffered the worst coral bleaching on record when water temperatures reached historic highs in 2016 and 2017. Bleached reefs take years or decades to recover. These critical marine ecosystems are home to thousands of species of plants and animals. That's why scientists want to help them recover faster. One night a year, the corals release eggs and sperm in a giant spawning event. Dunbabin and colleagues are there.
For the last week, we've been collecting coral spawn, rearing that, and now we're ready to distribute it using robotics.
They collect the coral spawn in this floating enclosure and raise them into larvae, says Southern Cross University professor Peter Harrison.
We're growing lots of larvae so that we can hopefully disperse them effectively on the reef to regenerate reef systems at a larger scale more efficiently. And Larvalbot is a concept that allows us to do that by pre-programming tracks along the reef to disperse the larvae.
The robot can disperse larvae across about 1,500 square meters per hour. The scientists are keeping an eye on the areas they seeded with Larvalbot to see how the coral recovers. They hope to refine the process and scale it up in the coming year. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. Our thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a wonderful day.